Everybody, welcome to this week's episode of Crime at the Family Table. I am one of your hosts, Latanya. And sadly, this week we will not be joined by Alyssa. I am so sorry, guys. You know, things get busy, and we will surely, be back as the little podcast that could next week, with all team members on and aboard. She sends her love, and she definitely didn't want to miss this week, but she surely will be back. I promise. It is just, the ups and downs of how things be going. So this week at Crime at the Family Table, I wanted to go over just a few things, just a few house information. So, this season we're doing decades of crime, so we're going through the decades of crime, and I believe we started in the 90s. So we're going all the way into 1900. And then our final episode will be on just shooting the shit, like our episode where we kind of go over a little more current eventy type stuff and current things going on crime, things that are kind of not connected to crime, but like certain like kind of cultural things, things that we kind of find interesting at the time. And we really enjoyed the last time we recorded it, so we try to make it like a every season type of deal. I want to apologize definitely because you probably hear my air conditioning in the background. If no one knows, like we are experiencing like a final heat wave of the summer, so air conditioners are staying on for the time being. So I want to apologize to all of my sensitive eared listeners out there. So, without further ado, let's get into this week's episode. So, this week I am doing the 1940s, which many people have called the war years. So, I want to give a few historical things to like kind of talk shop about like what the 1940s were all about. I'm pretty sure like if you've ever taken an American history class or a social studies class, like you know a lot about what went on in the 1940s, like dealing with the Holocaust and things involving just World War II in general. So this will be kind of course, like mentioning that, kind of first mentioning that, but then also getting into some extra stuff like inventions and things that were kind of just going on. And then we will move into our case. So I wanted to like kind of just give you some parameters of what you'll be listening to this week. So the year is 1940, the year is 1940. And in this year, so we are kind of making headway in that the war is happening, like that we are in pretty much a really big situation that's going on. And I say to you, like, because it's a world war. So we understand that in the 40s, we see the end of the world war going on in 1946. So, but in the beginning years, we kind of see like the things building up, especially on the other side of the pond, over in Europe. So what is going on is in Germany at this time, like the Nazis are having occupation over in Germany, and the Germans have Germans opened up Auschwitz, concentration camps in May of 1940, and then the first individuals from Austria, Germany, who had disabilities, who had disabilities, were put into gas chambers. So we're seeing the first kind of like people that are being being murdered, and executions that are going on inside Germany. Like we're seeing like who is like the first to go, and these are people with disabilities, and things are moving on pretty quickly. So in October of 1940, we see the first the Warsaw Ghetto opens, And this is where Jewish people were forced to reside, and they were not given much area to live in. So in a 1.3 square mile radius, nearly 460,000 Jewish people were housed within the Warsaw ghettos. And then in that same year, in November of 1940, FDR is given a never before seen third term. Like, I mean, yeah, because I mean, I think at this point we kind of get the understanding that, like, we don't see that. Like, we just, like, FDR is like this president that is known for one, of course, the New Deal, and which got us out of the Depression. But having three terms as a president, like, that is insanity. Like, I wouldn't say at that point it's never before seen, but like, I think he's one of, like, the, like, I think he is the actually the last president of, like, the last presidents who ever have three terms. Like, two term presidencies were, like, became a thing because, you know, you just cannot keep just getting elected. But a lot of that, I feel like, of course, had to do with the times. Like, we're dealing with war times, depression times, and he probably seemed like the only viable option at that point in time. So in the following year, we see our good fellow that we know of, if anybody is a fan of Marvel Comics, Captain America in 1941 was debuted at Marvel Comics. And it kind of makes sense because, as we know, if anybody's seen or what or what I mean read comics, like, Captain America is from the World War II era, and so he was created as a symbol of patriotism and the fight for America and this strong threshold. In June of 1940, we're going a little bit further back. Bugs Bunny debuted with Warner Brothers, and something else that was kind of crazy, nylon stockings were kind of put into more fashion during this time because silk stockings had to be used for the war effort. So they had to, and that was another thing, like, if at this time and we still see it to this day, but like, certain materials are just not, you're not able to get simply because we can't make it for this the people's use. We need it for the war. Like, we need to supply our soldiers with it. We saw that a lot, definitely in the pandemic, when a lot of places that, like, were just making, let's say, drinking alcohol now became a place that was making freaking hand sanitizer. So it definitely was something that was that like, it's kind of weird to see it, like, how, like, something we kind of use, like, nylon stockings, that's what we use all the time. Like, people use all the time. Like, well, I don't because I'm not in that age range yet, but if you, like, have to wear it, like, that's just something strange. All right, so another thing, so going forward to go some more historical stuff. So Cheerios, the cereal, which at that point was known as Cheerios, was introduced also in 1941. In May of 1941, in a kind of landslide, Joe DiMaggio, and it's crazy because I kind of remember hearing about this guy because, like, of this whole thing, he started a 56 game hitting streak, which ended, I believe, in June of 1941. In December of 1941, Pearl Harbor was hit by the Japanese. This then went on to in 1942 of February, FDR commanded that Japanese Americans were relocated from homes and businesses and put into internment camps. I think that is one of the most under talked about parts of history, is that we literally confined a group of people in America to internment camps, quote unquote. And it's one of the sickest things, and it's very interesting. Like, I would love to do, like, a whole rundown and, like, figure, like, and just talk about that. And I want to, like, just go into more background of what that really was, that experience was for people, like what those stories were, and what were like the aftermath. Because I feel like we talk about the war years as something like, oh, what was going on over there in that other country? Like the German people were so horrible, what they did to Jewish people. But we never talk about like what America really did to the Japanese in America, and how that kind of can like that kind of always happens, like the washing of history. Like they want to put a nice shining bow because we're American, we're never wrong. Continuing, in July of 1942, Anne Frank, who we've all, I'm sure, have read her diary, while in school for an assignment or two, and or if anybody's been to her museum, like I always wanted to know what that was like, what like that experience was like. I remember seeing it. I feel like it was in like a movie that like they had went to Anne Frank's museum. So in July of 1942, that is when like Anne Frank and her family go into hiding. In August of that year, the Manhattan Project is, which was about the funding efforts that were put behind the production of nuclear weapons, which we still see the devastation of today, is the and this is kind of prepping with for what is to come. So in 1943 of April, the Warsaw ghettos are residents are deported out of the ghettos and then taken to concentration camps. Those who did not or made refusals to leave or had fought or attempted to fight back were killed by the Nazis. And the ghettos were burnt down, and an estimated 13,000 people were killed. In 1944, of June 6th, D-Day, I believe like I've seen a couple of movies depicted like about D-Day. So I think there actually is a movie called D-Day. The Allies went to Normandy, the shores of Normandy, to liberate Europe from the Nazis. In 1945, World War II ended. Oh, I said 1946 earlier, it was 1945. Sorry. In April 12th, FDR died and Truman took over as president, President Truman. In April, Adolf and his wife, Yvonne, committed schmuicide with the use of cyanide and a pistol in a bunker in Berlin. In August 6th through the 8th, the US detonated two nuclear weapons in Japan, in Hiroshima and Nagasaki, which is still the devastation of, again, is still felt to this day. There's so much more to go into about like these events, like from the Manhattan Project to the destination to the internment camps, Japanese Americans. But I would honestly love to go into it in a different type of podcast, but I will proceed. In August 15th of 1945, Japanese Emperor Hirohito announces, sorry guys, I should have practiced this, announced the surrender of Japan, and basically saying like they give up and that America has won. August 10th through the 17th, Korea is divided between the North, which was with the Soviet Union, and the South, which was with the US, which is still felt today. That separation has not ever changed. In October 24th, the UN was founded in San Francisco, California, and August 29th, the ballpoint the my bad the Rayon pen, the early version of the ballpoint pen, went on for sale in November 1945. The Slinky toy was in that too. I haven't played with a Slinky toy since like I was a kid, and that's just me being a 90s child. I don't feel like people play with Slinky toys anymore. All right, a couple more things, and then we'll get into the case. In December of 1946. In December of 1946, the Flamingo Hotel opens in Vegas, which kind of started off like Vegas being known as like the freaking gambling capital of the world, pretty much. And the bright star of the West is kind of bought to be. Dang, like the Flamingo Hotel is like almost 100 years old. That is kind of crazy. In 1947, the Polaroid camera was introduced. In April of 1947, Jackie Robinson joins the Brooklyn Dodgers, becoming the first African American baseball player in the major leagues. In 1948, Mahatma Gandhi, a philosopher and leader of a philosopher and leader, was assassinated by a Hindu nationalist advocate. That okay. So, little side note. I know I kind of mentioned like I know I feel like everybody knows about Mahatma Gandhi, and a lot of people, especially Black people, I feel like our connection with Mahatma Gandhi, kind of our first introduction, is understanding that like Malcolm X took a lot of his nonviolent like philosophy from him, but Mahatma Gandhi was a horrible person. Like, we're just gonna put a pin in that and just like end of the day, because I have nothing to explain. He was just a horrible person. Look it up, folks. So in 1949, which we still see today, is the North Atlantic Treaty Organization came to be, which was NATO, which had an estimated of 29 countries that basically went into agreement. Like, if something happened with you, we got your back. If something happened with you, we got your back. And yeah, so pretty much that is like the 1940s in like encapsulation a little bit. I feel like I didn't even get into the fashions or like the movement. So like a lot of things were changing at this time. So we definitely got to see like a lot of women joining the workforce. This is like really inspire women's movements to get out from, well, I'm gonna say it. I'm gonna say the quiet part out loud. White women to get from outside of the households, from working inside of the home and being homemakers, into being in the work field because their husbands had to go out to war. But this also ended up also being like the time where we see like the baby boomers, like of course, like the baby boomers who we all kind of suffer with to this day, of like, just the changes of things, like a lot of, I guess, ups and downs, trials, tribulations that we still kind of deal with today. And the things that were ever changing, and how we kind of got into like the 1950s and the 60s, like of those big events of like shifting ideologies and changes from the 1940s. Yeah, so something I wanted to look up was, it was crazy because it kind of, I don't know why we haven't looked it up before. Like, what did crime look like during wartime? And so, like, wartime, we're also going to think about also the 30s into this and the 40s. So, during this time, like, and I'm keeping it to America because the case we're talking about today is also is in America. So, gotta try to keep it together, folks. So, as you know, like the Depression was going on around this time. So at the same time that war was happening. So theft and burglary was a huge issue in America, because when people are down and out and they don't have their needs being met, or not unable to get their needs met, they're going to be resort to crime. And a lot of that is going to be financial crime. Some of the figures do not show women having a huge thing in like in robberies and burglaries, but some of the things like that women had things doing like involvement in was things that involved what this article talks about: sex appeal, deceit, and fraud. So I'm going to assume, and I don't want to make 100% assumptions, is that this is dealing with like probably sex crimes or crimes of like some type of scamming. So things that would basically have the lower risk of like bodily harm and still could get their needs met without having to necessarily use like brute force. Another thing was like crimes amongst young people were, of course, on the rise because there is a whole generation, like a whole ton of men, that have been drafted into the war. So it leaves a lot of young people to kind of fend for themselves with their moms. And so, not to, this is to you manosphere people. This is not that. It is saying that because, like a whole subset of people is just gone. And then on top of that, you have these unforeseen times of like strife and instability on all fronts. Like it creates youth that are not necessarily also being watched because like it's kind of we just try and survive. Like it's not easy. So crime rates among juveniles does increase during this time, and it becomes a huge issue. And we still see that, of course, today. Like anytime we have issues in regards to like huge moments of strife, like right now we're dealing with a recession, we're dealing with inflation rates that have like are historically high, we're dealing with people not being able to get into the workforce like they want to. We're having a lot of youth crimes now. Now more on the violent end of the spectrum, but still like a high end of youth crimes. Like I cannot tell you how often, especially in Philadelphia, we see youth that are on TV for something with a gun or something involving trying to steal or something. Like because we are in so much uncertain times, and if basic needs are not really being provided for, and you feel this sense of hopelessness, it only can inspire pretty negative results. All right, before we get into today's case, I would like to make a disclaimer that this case does involve some violent depiction, and it does involve just, I guess you can say some police violence, but you would have to understand it. It's kind of context to maybe understand it, but if you there's something you do not want to hear about, I completely understand. Please take care of yourself. Always put yourself first, and maybe we'll have a case in the future that will be more your speed. All right. So without further ado, let's get into it. So during the 1940s, and like really just the early part of like the 1900s, like you definitely see this sense of safety that people had, like naivety about the world, because you only could really understand what was going on in the world from your worldview. And meaning there wasn't stuff on the news and or tracking apps where you could see what crime is going on in your area, like that you would know what was happening. Like the Citizens Act was not a thing in the 1940s. I'm so sorry, folks. And if it wasn't, it would probably be driving older people crazy, and we probably wouldn't be able to do nothing if the Citizens Act existed in 1940. So, and one of the most commonalities like that we see, and people would talk about like it was so safe, people would just leave their doors unlocked. And that time has long since passed. I mean, there's still are some play people that like say that they live in communities where they feel comfortable enough to leave their stuff in the leave their doors unlocked because they live in such a tight-knit community and nothing really happens. I wouldn't do it, but you know, to each his own. And that was something that would have terrible results for the women in this case. So in December for oh, oh sorry. Somewhere in Louisiana, some small no punk town in Louisiana with probably no street signs, and according to the villain of this story, Jake Bird, it was such a small town that it didn't even have a post office. They probably had to share it with the next town over. Jake Bird was born into the world. I say small town because we don't have any information on what his town was. He didn't even know. And he doesn't really go into like really what his childhood looks like. So we don't know how he grew up. We don't know if he grew up with his parents. We don't know if he grew up with other relatives. But what we do know is by the time Jake Bird was 19 years old, he left his home. He left his home and never looked back. He started this transient lifestyle. And I'm pretty sure people know about like this, like people that they're gonna find a way, there ain't no way. They'll walk on their feet. They just gonna do what needs to be done in order to make their life as comfortable as possible. And one of the ways that Bird would do this was he would sometimes do some day labor work. So day labor work on the railroads. And this was an easy way for him to go from town to town and find jobs, make some easy money, be able to stay the night somewhere, and then be gone by the next day. So he does this for a while. He does these odd jobs, and he makes sure that, oh, I got somewhere to sleep tonight. It's fine. He never really settles down anywhere. It's not known if he ever has children during this time. I mean, potentially, we never know. He could have left a kid in every town that he'd been to. But we do know that his life was not without his legal trouble. So Bird would always find himself kind of doing what he kind of felt comfortable with, and it was from quick, easy cash. So he would commence to doing robberies, burglarizing homes. And by the time the end of this case happens, he has a record that includes robbery, burglary, murder, and attempted murder. Culminated, he spends about 31 years in prison for various offenses. He does not miss a chance with a run-in with the law. Bert was one of those people that was kind of like an anomaly. Like he kind of like what he did and how he moved about the world was like very, I mean, it kind of was situational. Like it's an anomaly now, like because some people couldn't like imagine this. Like you're just living downtown, just committing crime, and like I think what was also kind of made him more of an anomaly, I feel like to me, was that Bird was a black man, and the crimes he is committing, are like insane. And the fact that he kind of just keep going, like he just gets released. Yes, he gets caught. Like he's not walking around a free man, but he just gets out and just does it again and again and again. And he's like pretty much allowed to kind of just go. And I guess they couldn't really stop him because he has no freaking mailing address. Like they didn't know where to pick up. And then around that time, like you just hop on a bus and just be somewhere else and no one's tracking you. But it would be the sad result of a night on, it's kind of hard to say because in 1947, the Pandora's box opens for Bird. And kind of everything kind of comes to a head because we're kind of, a lot of things are lost to time because, of course, he's moving a lot. So, but it was 1947 where Pandora's box really becomes open for Bird. At 2:30 a.m. in a Tacoma residence, neighbors hear screams coming from the 1007 South 21st Street home, and two police officers, a number of police officers come out to this home. One officer by the name of Andrew P. Sabatis, who is a former prize fighter, and Evan Skip Davies came to the residence where they were met with a barefoot man that clearly had blood on him. And this man wastes no time in barreling out in the back door through the picket fence and climbed several more back door fences before stopping at 2122 South J Street, where he then tries, because he couldn't climb this fence. The fence clearly was too high, and I'm guessing it had no areas where he could like kind of hitch himself up. So he decides that he's going to fight his way out of it. So he proceeds to pull out a knife, and cut Skip, and then stabbed Sabatis in the shoulder. However, Sabatis was not going down without a fight. This is where that prize fighter situation comes in. So Sabatis punches the suspect. At this point, they do not know who this man is. In the head, in the face, and then kicks him in the groin in order to get him down. And when this man goes to the hospital, he has lacerations on his head and face. Now, we're gonna come back to these lacerations on head and face because, yeah, it's very, very interesting. So other officers are at the home at 1007 South 21st Street. And when the officers come into the home, they are met with a gruesome scene. Mother and daughter were found murdered within the home. 52-year-old Bertha Colt was found in her bedroom, and adjacent to her bedroom is the kitchen where her 17-year-old daughter, Beverly June Colt, was found. It is clear that they were beyond recognition, and they at the scene there was an axe that was the clear weapon. Both women had clearly been bludgeoned, beaten, and hit with the axe multiple times. The crime the officers state that they believe that the motive for this crime was the assault of Bertha, and that Beverly had come down from her room when she heard her mother being hurt, because the suspect did not know that Bev may have not know realized that Beverly was in the house and caught the man, and then the man proceeded to kill Beverly after killing the mom, Bertha. So officers do find out who the suspect is. Jake Bird is interrogated by detective lieutenant from the Pierce County Police Station, Sherman Lyons, at the Tacoma jail. So Tacoma, sorry, Tacoma jail. Just oh, also just so you know, we're in Tacoma, Washington. So yes, Jake had been traveling so much. Like he has went from Louisiana to Washington State, clear onto the West Coast, from the deep South into the West Coast. It's kind of crazy. So Jake basically it pretty much like admitted to the crime. But he claims like a different situation happened. So basically he says that in the backyard there is like a shed, and it's believed that this shed is shared, either like it either is the neighbor's shed or it is the Colt shed. But that's neither here or there. So I keep calling him Jake, but his name is Jack. So sorry, Jack Bird. Jack Bird, so he takes this axe, and he claims that the axe was kind of like a scare tactic. Like he was not trying to use the axe. It was kind of just like, oh, like if they see I have a weapon, they're le le less likely to stop me. So he claims that he went into the house. Before going in, he took off his shoes because I'm guessing he didn't want to make noise, and he went in and went into the purse and to Bertha's purse and retrieved $1.50. Yes, big score, folks. Like, even at that time, I just feel like $1.50, babe, just leave the $1.50. Like, it's crazy. And he claims that Bertha then was behind him when he was in the, I'm guessing, like, kitchen close to her bedroom area. And he basically claims he told Bertha that he just came to take the money and then, like, he's just gonna head out. But then he states that Beverly came up behind him and attacked him and started grabbing him, and that is what resulted in the two women's death. Completely don't believe this shit, because that literally makes no sense, like, by any frame of the imagination. By October 31st of 1947, it's like a month later, deputy prosecutor the deputy prosecutor of Pierce County charged Byrd with the first degree murder of Beverly. So this is a common practice at this time. I don't feel like it's as common now, because nowadays, like, this wouldn't happen. So they would charge the person with, like, if let's say you commit two murders, like as Byrd did, they're gonna only charge you with one of the murders because just in case that murder fails to kind of stick, like, they can't stick the offense, they can just always just go for the second murder. So you're just never getting out of prison. Like, so even if, like, they had just the time, they can just pull that from the back of their ass and said, like, here I go with a bunny in my hat. Like, I'm just gonna keep pulling shit out of the bag because you're never gonna get out of prison. So yeah, so that was the plan. So they're gonna take Beverly case and boom, and pretty much they're saying, well, regardless, like, if you get one, you're gonna get the other, because if they're saying you committed her act as first degree murder, the following would be that you also committed the second murder. Same old, same old. And it's not saying that if you're found not guilty for the first one, or the first one doesn't stick, that you're automatically not guilty for the second one. It just means that they can just pull that back and be like, well, we're just gonna charge you for the second murder. It's kind of like the idea, like, if you commit a crime, if you commit, like, if you commit, like, a robbery and or like whatever, like, and they be like, oh yeah, like, you also, like, stole this other thing, and they be like, oh well, like, I didn't. And then, but if they find evidence that you did something else, like another crime during that time, they're gonna charge you for the robbery, which is smaller, like, probably a smaller offense. And then they're just gonna get you for that big shit later. Like, that's more common now. Like, they start with small shit to build up to big shit. But back then it was just like, no, just take two big crimes. All right. So although Byrd did confess, like, he still pled not guilty. So he wanted to take this to trial. Stupid mistake. The presiding judge was Judge Edward D. Hodge, and he had a defense lawyer, James Sheldon, who was also a former Pierce County prosecutor. And the biggest question that loomed over this trial was, could a black man receive a fair trial at this time? And honestly, like, this was played into. So the trial was speedy, to say the least. So, like I said, he was filed charges against in, like, October 31st of 1947, and by November the trial had begun. The trial literally only took like a day and a half, with prosecutor M. Steeles went on to basically saying that this was a premeditated murder. And that because it's premeditated, that trying it as first degree, so that's the thing. Like, we're also going to have this in next season, so we're going to be going over terminology, crime terminologies, and stuff like that. But the premeditation is what makes first degree murder first degree murder. And the idea is, like, here's the thing. The idea is that they're saying He premeditated because he had this weapon. He could have easily just broke in. And also another thing to say on a side note is that the reason why, so when he went into the house, like he went into the house just walking in, and that's why I said my little part in the beginning, like the door was unlocked. And because during this time, a lot of people just did not lock their doors, like it was just common practice. And he walks in with an axe, and he literally just could have walked in and left. But they're saying that, or like scared them or whatever, and just got out of there. And then, like, of course, with this transient lifestyle that he lives, he could have just ridden a train into the sunset and went on to the next town or state that he wanted to. But no, Bird is an evil person. So during this time, we of course have some forensic testing that can be done, which is fingerprints were pretty common at this time, and also on Bird's clothes, blood and brain tissue were found of the victims. One of the only, I believe there was only one witness that the prosecutor seals brought up, and that was Officer John Hickey, and who admitted at this time. And so this is where we get into back with the lacerations on Bird's face and head. So basically, Hickey and Russell Scatum and had beat up Bird, and he admitted to this on the stand. So basically, Hickey had said that him and Russell had went into the home, and they had saw this gruesome scene, and then they went out to the paddy wagon, and they basically said like you did that to them, and he admitted like he and then Jake like I mean Jack said like no I didn't, and then like he had like this smug smirk on his face, and him and Russell snapped and they beat him up. And he basically says like he regrets doing that, but like it was just kind of like the heat of the moment. And that's why when Bert was taken to the hospital, he had lacerations on his face and head from that beating. It wasn't from Stodom punching him and hitting him in the groin. It was from this beating. And that was like something that was like kind of mentioned. So basically then when Steele tried to, after having the witness enter the confession done by Bird into evidence, Sheldon, the defense attorney, objected to this, stating that basically it was done under duress. You just had your witness admit that he beat on him, and then this confession happened to the murders. And what the judge, Hoover, was just not, he didn't give a fuck, to put it lightly. So pretty much, Hodge said, no, overruled. I mean, I'm sticking in my little law and order talk. Overruled because those two things are two separate incidences. And he's like, what? Yeah, like, so basically, the judge said that the confession was done at this point in time, and that beating was done at this point in time. They have nothing to do with each other at all. And nowadays, like, it's like I'm laughing because like it's so laughable, because like all I kept thinking about was the case that shall not be named, and how basically like this case, like even though like there's of course other evidence like the blood and the brain tissue, but like the fact that like they could just say like a beating and then the confession are just two different things would just not fly these days. Like it just wouldn't, like we would just like a little bit like no, like he beat that confession out of him, but like we all know Bird's guilty, but still, like it's just like wow, that's crazy. Like he could just say, oh, those two different matters. I don't know. They're not even sisters, like they're cousins to each other. They don't even really know each other like that. So Hodge basically disagrees and says that the confession was given voluntarily. It has nothing to do with that beating. And after basically the prosecution rests, Sheldon had no more tricks up his sleeve. So he kept trying to object and strike down the things that were being said, but it just didn't work. Closing arguments were done by November 26th. And the nine jurors, which consisted of six men and three women, were left to deliberate, and it literally took them a whopping 35 minutes to find Byrd guilty of first degree murder and sentence him to death. So at this time, so this is like something else, like most likely go over next season, is that we now have a system where it's like two different events. So like you have your when you are found guilty, you're found guilty, but then you have your sentencing date, which could be like a month or so away or a few weeks or whenever. But back then, no, it's all done in one little finely wrapped situation. So, first degree murder, and on December 6th, on December 6th, Bert was sentenced to be hanged by January 16th of 1948. Yes, like all within less than a year, like less than a year, this man has literally had a trial, been found guilty, and told he's going to be hanged in the next few weeks. Like literally, like boom, 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 boom. Like now, like this is like almost completely unheard of. Like it's like 2 years at minimum for cases. Like minimum, pretty much. Like the average, I feel like with cases like this, it's like 2 years. But by back then, they was like, no, we don't even have to get any drugs. Like we're just gonna hang you, and that's just how it was gonna go. Sheldon did make a final attempt at trying to get a new trial, which was denied, and then Sheldon pretty much showed court he did everything he could do. And he is then quoted as telling the court, any 45-year-old that gets an idea that no one's life except his own are safe, that man is a detriment to society and should be obliterated. And that, when I read that, I said, and I, ooh, because that is just not heard of. You like we just like li literally like I have like watched so many true crime things and like defense attorneys. The person literally is sitting in prison. The person is dead. Like the person has gone on to pasture. They are rocking with that client till the wheels fall off. And Sheldon said no. And I feel like it also has something to do with one because Bird is black. But also too because this man is like a former prosecutor. Like he don't give a like he's about the lie. I mean, and technically he kind of did try his best because at the end of the day, it's like the smoking gun. Like your fingerprints were found on the axe. They're like you were found bloody with brain matter tissue on you. The blood and brain, like you were found leaving the house, like you were found freaking red-handed, if anything. Like, I mean, like it really wasn't what Sheldon could do. And Bird took offense to this though. Bird took offense to this quote. He said basically he did not get a fair trial and that even his defense attorney had left him out to dry. And he wasn't done. So not only was he just sick and tired of everybody and didn't give a f, he decided that he was going to what is now known as the Jack Byrd hex on to people, basically telling people that all you got guys who had anything to do with this will die before I do. And it's kind of crazy, but like literally a month later in January of 1948, Judge Hodge dies of a heart attack, and four other people connected to this case, and like including like officers and other people that are connected to this case, also die. Some of these people are also a little older, but still, like it was crazy. It was like kind of like, oh, maybe this man really did put a hex on these folks. Shortly after Byrd's arrival to prison, he decides like, hey, I'm not going down without a fight. So he is being shipped off to Washington State Penitentiary in Walla Walla, And on December 7th, Bird decides, okay, well, I got some things to tell y'all. Those the cult crimes that I did, yeah, that's only the tip of the iceberg. I have committed dozens of other murders over the past 20 years. So although the clock was running out, the Washington governor, Morad Charles Walgreen, and Pierce County prosecutor, Patrick Steele, who we met before, and the detective lieutenant, Sherman Lyons, they went to listen to Bird's confession. And it's this com like so the governor told them to go, like told the prosecutor and the officer to go to the prison and listen to his confession. This resulted in a 174-page report that was put on the governor office desk, which resulted in a 60-day hold for his execution in order to investigate the 44 murders that Bird was confessing to. Bird's confession brought on investigators from across the country, because he's saying that Washington, that's not my only thing. That I've been all over this country committing travesties and you don't even know about it. Although he like many man hours were spent in the investigation into his claims and the connection that Bird has in these cases, it was only found that about 11 of these cases could be actually linked to Bird. These and most of these murders were women. So, and they pretty much kind of followed the same MO, like the burglary connection and all of this stuff. So the states that he was involved in were Illinois, Kentucky, Nebraska, Oklahoma, Kansas, South Dakota, Ohio, Florida, Wisconsin, Michigan, Ohio, and Washington. Bird had been on every corner of this country committing murder. And while this was going on, while like investigators were probably spinning in their heads, because this is before databases, so these officers like literally had to be called and like ride a train, catch a plane, and come over. Like there was no automated system. So, and while this was going on, Bert was just like, oh yeah, like about all that, I still don't want to die for the murders I committed on the Colts. So he then attempts to appeal his conviction in the Washington State current Supreme Court, and attempting to get a new trial, stating that Judge Hodge had biases which resulted in judicial errors. However, on November 30th, his final petition was denied, and on December 3rd, this is mind you 1948, so like he it's a whole nother year. He was issued another death sentence to be handed down on January 14th of 1949. Byrd's now appeals attorney, Murray Taggart, tried to again have another stay of execution for Byrd on the basis of appeals filing to the appeals court. It was granted as long as the appeals court was willing to review it. They weren't. And Bird was handed down another execution to be done on July 15th. No attempts again were made. They were kept trying to do appeals and they kept getting denied, and nobody was listening to. They just did not. Yeah, they even tried to get clemency from the new governor, Arthur B. Langley. Did not work. He did not want to hear it. He's like, bruh, you're gonna hang. You're done. You're done. And that's exactly what happened. So on July 14th of 1949, in the evening, Bird was given his final meal. He was able to talk to his attorney. He was given a clean shave and new clothes. And the warden of the Washington State Prison, Tom Smith, and two prison guards walked him to the gallows, where 125 people awaited to witness him the execution. And at 12:20 a.m. on July 15, 1949, Jake Bird was hanged. He was pronounced dead by the prison physician and buried in a unmarked prison grave for. As convict 21320. And I guess something could be said about Bird that he really liked his appeals attorney because he left Bird with the last money in his pocket, $6.15. What a guy. Sarcasm, folks. Sarcasm. And that is the insane case of Jake Bird. I mean, Jack Bird. Jack Bird is really considered at the time a prolific serial killer. I am surprised that I have not heard about him before in this case. It is insane to me. He was known as, like they love giving these serial killers names. He was known as the ex-murderer of Tacoma. And I will call him, and probably what this will be titled, a confession killer. Because it's not like 100%. Like, I don't know if they've ever revisited more of these cases to maybe check for DNA. I did not see that in my research. Sorry, folks. But it does look like, yeah, like he is like pretty much one of the big ones. Like, he can be up there with like the Ted Bundys of the world, like the big ones. But he is not notable in history, and it's so crazy to think about this, but like the racism that is also involved in that, because they assigned kind of the idea of serial killers and these savants and these people that are better than everybody. But literally a lot of serial killers, and like I feel like I want to get into this next season, is like talking about like this idea of serial killers and like this how romanticization of serial killers happens, because they often paint them as white men, and it creates this picture that they are so much better. But really, a lot of what serial killers are is the inept, they rely a lot on inept policing and also the ability of the times. So Bird only ability to be this, oh, great serial killer, for example, oh my God, and that's the wrong, not the good great serial killer, is the fact that he could travel, and like the ability to go state to state was so easy on the railroad. He lived this transient lifestyle. Now you literally cannot sleep on a park bench without people noticing you. Cell phones exist. Like, it is definitely difficult. Like, the idea of a serial killer was more accessible, I guess, in that time, is because the technology is just different, and the aptitude of policing was just different. The way information travels is different. The times change, and that's the good thing. Crimes are being solved. Cold cases are being solved. We now have serial killers that probably would have been long gone, like the Golden State, the Golden Gate serial killer, or the original Night Stalker case was solved because of the revelation, the science being around now. So yeah, like Bird would not have been able to do what he's doing, or maybe he was, because hitting small towns, world may never know. But he, a lot of what it was reliant on the time. And again, one of the bigger things was the ability for people to see themselves as being safer than what they were. And so I asked folks, remember to lock your doors tonight, stay safe. And I look forward to you guys listening in next week for the 1930s. See you guys next week. Bye.